Hello, I'm Nicholas Barrett.
And I'm Julie Anderson.
And I'm Gottram Wolf.
And you're listening to The Sound of Economics. Now, for the past few months, we've covered Europe's lack of uptake in the emerging field of artificial intelligence. America has spent the last decade breeding AI unicorns, while China is using big data to streamline the lives of millions of people, whether they like it or not. Meanwhile, Europe has been writing rules, but falling behind. Here at Bruegel, we've talked a lot about what a European approach towards AI might look like, and soon we'll get to find out. Julia has been reading a leaked white paper from the European Commission, setting out an ambitious approach. So Julia, what's in this document and why does it matter?
So the white paper is structured broadly around two objectives. One is to promote uptake, and there it proposes some actions, six to be precise, and it also proposes a regulatory framework to mitigate risks. So we can go into more details as to the different proposed actions. But as an introduction, I think it's really interesting to note that what the white paper potentially achieves is to take two seemingly contradictory priorities for AI and combine them into one opportunity for the EU. So let me explain what I mean by that. So first, we know that EU is missing the AI boat, or it's really afraid of lagging behind, and it is according to some measures. So for instance, only 2 out of the 100 most promising AI startups are European. And here the language of the white paper very much tries to communicate this ambition. So we see terms like global champion or race to become a global leader. So that's the industrial policy objective. On the other hand, there's this desire to tackle the societal and ethical challenges that come with AI. And here I don't need to rehearse the potential safety and privacy issues around facial recognition or bias in automated decision making. So these are the regulatory objectives. And usually we think of those as contradictory. So we think that if we have a strong regulatory framework, we will hamper growth, we will stifle innovation. But here the white paper reversed the logic, and it seems to set regulation as not a barrier, but rather a business opportunity for the EU. So we've been hearing lately that China has data, US has the money, and EU has the purpose. And what we really mean by that is that EU has a certain vision for what AI, trustworthy AI, should be. So what it looks like is that the regulatory framework is an opportunity to offer a differentiated EU product, one that is trustworthy. And here the EU proposes a EU label in the white paper. And this would increase the demand for AI in the EU and thus the offering potentially for AI in the EU. And finally, the relationship is also reversed in that by creating a regulated EU AI, we would also address the lack of trust from citizens and the lack of legal certainty from businesses, which is identified as one of the key impediment to uptake in the EU. There's even a statistic in the white paper that says that 60% of enterprises fear liability issues, and that's a big reason for them not to adopt AI. The trustworthy AI would increase demand for AI, which would potentially increase the business offering in the EU.
So Guntram, it seems like the European Union wants to move forward enthusiastically, but with caution. Now, can it possibly move at the same pace as America or China with so many concerns?
Well, I think Margrethe Vestager, the Executive Vice President of the Commission, who's in charge and leads this project on AI, really faces a fundamental dilemma. And the fundamental dilemma is that European companies need to adopt AI. They need to adopt AI if they want to be leading. Why? Well, basically because AI is a key cross-cutting technology that matters on so many dimensions. It matters for your supply chain management. It matters for your industrial management in the factories. It matters for all the key assets European companies have. So AI adoption is critical. At the same time, there is very little European AI. So AI is basically an American and a Chinese technology. There is, of course, some AI in Europe, but the dominance of those two blocks is very significant. And so the real question here is, well, can you adopt foreign AI? Does that create concerns? And how do you deal with these concerns? And on top of that, and I think you mentioned, both of you mentioned this, I think is this question of, well, how do we deal with the hesitation towards the technology, right? I mean, I think that's less of an issue on the corporate side. It's more an issue on the sort of side of individuals, private individuals that fear that this technology might be misused, and you know, there's privacy issues, and you know, there's human-centered AI is the buzzword that that Brussels uses. So there's these concerns, and of course you have to take these concerns very seriously. But I think at the core of her portfolio, but also the one of Thierry Breton, the commissioner in charge of the single market, is really this tension: how to deal with AI adoption in the corporate sector in Europe.
So last month we had the CEO of Google. He came to Bruegel and he said there should probably be a moratorium, a slowdown on facial recognition technology, and it seemed like the EU might go along with that.
Google, for now, because we realized facial recognition is fraught with risks. So I think it's important that governmental regulation tackles it sooner rather than later and gives a framework for it.
But then last week they seemed to back away from it. So a lot of these things that make us nervous initially, eventually there's like an acceptance that this just has to be a part of the future.
So who slowed down again? The Commission or the
Commission decided that they didn't want a moratorium on facial recognition technology.
Well, I mean, I don't have a final view on facial recognition. I mean, I certainly think facial recognition creates lots of very, very complicated questions. And in fact, of course, we know that facial recognition already exists, right? I mean, so Google and other search engines can recognize Facebook and so on, recognize pictures and recognize these pictures very easily. The AI technology is there. So AI is better now. Visual recognition of machine learning algorithms is better than humans in recognizing who you are. So the technology is there. The data is there. And in a sense, it's just a question of how it will be deployed, and you know, whether you can limit the deployment of that technology. So in the end, perhaps one reason, and I don't know why the Commission is now tracking back. Perhaps one reason is that they feel it's difficult to really backtrack, because any case there will be actors using it, and because the technology is there.
I mean, thousands of Europeans are already using facial recognition technology just to unlock their phones. Is it possible that we can't regulate at the speed of innovation, and technology is just running away from us?
Well, I think in the end, it's not just regulation. I think we need to think much more in terms of institutions. And, you know, a regulation is worthless if there's no institution enforcing it. So I think we need to think about, in case there is a concern, whom do you turn to and who can judge and defend your rights as citizens? So I think regulation should, in a sense, AI regulation should empower the individual, should make sure that liabilities are clear, and the liabilities in the AI space are not fundamentally different from liabilities elsewhere. But then the enforcement of these rights, I think, is the central issue. And it seems to me that we need to think much more carefully about this. And I asked exactly that question to the Google CEO. And I think there's much more work that needs to be done in that space. We need institutions that react quickly and where you can turn to and that defend the interests of the individuals. But still, I think the broader, I think these are sort of the consumer side issues. But I think an even bigger challenge is the industrial side. So companies, how do they adopt and what kind of technology do they adopt and what kind of concerns do we have when they adopt this technology? I think that's a very big issue, because we are at this pivotal moment in where the economy transforms and where everything becomes digital, and where a strength that we thought we had, for example, in terms of having a car, well, turns out to be now basically a data-driven utility, right? So you don't produce cars anymore. You basically produce the data, and then the car is just a supplement to the data and to the algorithms that drive this car. So I think there's a fundamental transformation in the industry that is ongoing and in industrial processes. And Europe is relatively weakly positioned in terms of the technology at this stage. And I think that's a big headache, actually.
So in December, you and I went to the Berlimon and we met Margriet Vestager, the commissioner responsible for competition and European AI strategy. And we asked her if the economy based around the accumulation of data would create competition concerns and would create monopolies.
I think that AI will develop. And also, I think that the use of data will develop. That it's not only for you who harvest a lot of data yourself to advance in AI, it's also for you who, in clever ways, pool data, share data, reuse data. I think that artificial intelligence as a technology will develop so that it will also be extremely useful for companies who deal with data in a different way than a giant harvester would do.
Julia, this is something you've been writing about recently for the Google website. So how much of a concern is this, that once you have the most amount of data, you'll just be able to leave your rivals, your business rivals, in the dust and create services that are just completely incomparable to those of the companies around you?
Well, I've been looking at those issues lately, and I find it's a very delicate question, and it's going to depend very much on the application. So there's machine learning applications, which is a subfield of AI, which is what we typically mean by AI these days, that doesn't require data at all.
So for those who don't know, what's the difference between artificial intelligence and machine learning?
Well, machine learning is just a subset of artificial intelligence, whereby the person that is, or rather, whereby the algorithm doesn't need to be coded with specific rules. So you simply, I mean, simply is, you input the data and you produce an algorithm that will generate predictions based on the past information that it has been fed. But that's for a subfield of machine learning. There are subfields of machine learning that don't require any data at all. So this is self-reinforcement learning. But for those that require data, there can be applications where the more the data, the more competitive the product. And this has led to a lot of debate within the economic field, with on one hand people arguing that data exhibits what is called decreasing returns to scale. So yes, 100 data points will be very useful for me to learn about a certain relation, but past a certain threshold, past a certain quantity of data, the extra observation really leads to marginal benefits.
I mean, just to explain this point in for the layman, I think the first 100 observations are extremely useful to be able to detect what is a dog. The second 100 observations are perhaps much less useful because the algorithm has already learned. So in a sense, the first 100 observations are very important. The second 100 are much less important for being able to recognize the dog. I mean, just to explain in simple terms, this decreasing return to data, which is sort of one hypothesis on data. But then there's the other hypothesis.
Well, so a further argument is, okay, even if we have those decreasing returns to scale, and there's a point where the extra piece of information brings very small benefits, there are cases where those small benefits matter to at least a few users. And those few users, if they switch to the algorithm that provides that extra, however small, quality, if they switch over, then they provide more data, because more users means more data. And this is what creates a feedback loop, as it's called in the literature, whereby small quality increases attract a few more users, which provide more data, which provides further small quality increases, etc., etc. So this is a case where even if we see the decreasing returns to scale, we could still see increasing returns to scale in terms of economic benefits. And that means that it might not be enough to just have a lump sum quantity of data in order to compete viably in a machine learning market. The person or the firms that holds the most data may be the one that captures most of the market share.
I mean, just to perhaps extend on this, I think this is sort of the core of the question is how important is data, access to data for artificial intelligence, and where should the regulator come in to make sure that the benefits of the data don't just go to one company, but really are more equally spread. And there are arguments for and against all of these points. But I think one big discussion is here again, coming back to our industrial data question, who owns the data from industrial processes? Who owns the data, for example, that I generate when I drive a car? Is this access to this data, is it limited to just the company who has provided the AI? Or should European regulation actually empower the companies that perhaps buy the AI applications to actually use these data for further development of their own algorithms and improve their own algorithms? So this question of the access of the data and who owns the data and who can use, both who owns the data but also who can use, has the right to use the data. Because even if you don't own the data, there might be ways of sharing data, including with some synthetic data. I mean, there's a debate on synthetic data where you sort of modify them slightly, these data, so that they get anonymized, but they can still be used for machine learning. So the machine can still learn with these data. So how do we deal with this? I think this is one of the crucial issues of the future AI strategy, especially given that we don't have the AI technology here in Europe, but at least we have the data. And can we make sure that these data don't disappear, but really are as much as possible to the benefit of European companies and European welfare at the end of the day?
So while you could argue that tech firms have innovated and invested to accumulate data in vast sums, it's ultimately humans who create that data. And from a philosophical point of view, that could give us some claim to the intellectual copyright for it, or the intellectual property, as that were. Now, I guess the arguments for sharing and recycling data, which is what Vestager suggested when we interviewed her on this podcast, they would be quite obvious. They would be that it creates a more level playing field for markets and so on, and a more accessible market, as it were. But I suppose the arguments against that is that if you have data that can be shared and recycled and so on, you create an environment where the incentive to innovate and the incentive to go forward is less than what it would be in America and China, and then they sweep up the gains while we're still kind of having this weird sort of data commonwealth, I suppose.
Yes, I agree. I think there's important trade-offs, I think in a sense, with our European data protection regulation, we have already created the possibility that consumers take ownership of their own data. Mm. So consumers, in theory, can actually empower companies to collect data from all kinds of different sources. I mean, there's an example in the health industry where you could empower a company basically saying, you can have access to all my personal data, no matter whether Google has saved them or, your smartwatch producer or somebody else. You combine them all and you create a product for me. So the property of the data, in a sense, is the individual property. But we don't yet have quite the same level of regulation when it comes to industrial data. And I think that's why, again, this is I think, the one of, and to be honest, I think the personal data regulation, while looking strong, I think is still very much in, the practice is still very much in development, it seems to me. I'm not so sure that we can yet claim that GDPR is a full success.
But do you worry that even these like modest regulations would incentivize companies and just individual talented engineers to base themselves in London and California instead of Brussels and Paris?
Well, I think Julia mentioned already, we have of the 100 promising startups, only two are in the EU. Six are actually in the UK, and the rest is outside of Europe. So indeed, I mean, at the moment we have a problem in terms of companies, in terms of really AI capacity on the continent. And I think part of the bigger strategy needs to be, how do we foster and boost the ecosystem so that that technology develops here? Because we cannot allow that technology to exist only outside of Europe. It would actually put our own sovereignty, our own capacity to deal with these things into question. So there needs to be a European AI strategy, not just on regulating data, but also boosting artificial intelligence technology here at home.
And I think it's quite telling that what was supposed to be part of the white paper on artificial intelligence, a section on data, has been outsourced into a completely separate paper that deals only with data that hopefully will be released on the same day.
That's interesting. I was just thinking that obviously maybe it seems like from what we're saying that the EU is kind of at the mercy of these big tech firms and the engineers and the talent, but we also have as leverage a huge market. And basically for any AI to be dominant, it's going to have to, well, for any tech firm to be dominant, it's really going to have to reach European consumers. And the EU does have a say over what can reach European consumers. So can Vestager or Brussels or whoever's in charge of this regulation create rules that influence artificial intelligence around the world?
I think yes. I think European regulatory power matters for these global developments. I think we should also not fool ourselves, obviously. I mean, Chinese technology is advancing irrespective of what is being regulated here in Europe, and also American technology will develop irrespective of what we do here. But there is at least some scope to set standards, to influence the global regulatory environment, to improve rights of individuals, rights of property, and so on and so forth. So I don't think we have lost the game completely. We have the regulatory power. I'm more worried on the entrepreneurial side, the company side.
Mm. So, Julie, when you were reading this leaked white paper, how did you feel when you were reading it? Did it give you confidence in Brussels? Did it make you worry that we might lose our initiative to other places? I mean, does it come across as a robust document to you?
I mean, I think the idea of embedding the regulatory objectives within the business objective really interesting. And I can see how for a business wishing to implement AI in its internal operations, that it would be able to adopt an AI that gives it a sense of security on the legal side if it adopts AI that can be explainable, if it can adopt AI that can be liable if anything happens. Seems to me like a strong offering.
Hmm. Can AI be accountable if only a fraction of the population can comprehend an algorithm?
I don't see why not. There's a lot of areas where the average person doesn't understand much. And
I think even if nobody understands the algorithm, I think there is this, very confusing debate on explainability. I think explainability is not the point. I mean, the whole point of having a good algorithm is that the algorithm is actually smarter than you are. Now, what you need to be sure is that it acts within confines set by you. And those need to be enforceable. And you need to be able to hold the owner of that AI accountable. And so liability is key. It's not about explainability. It's about liability and clear framework conditions. And I think there we really can lead the way in Europe.
I just have this anxiety that the regulators are always going to be a few months behind the algorithms. They're always going to catch up to the problems after the damage has been done.
Yeah, that's right. But I think the issue is much more an institutional issue. It's not about regulation. It's much more about empowering institutions to enforce standards and to enforce liability.
Hmm. And can you tell us a little bit about the article you've been writing this week?
Well, I mean, I think I already captured quite a bit of it. I think the key issue is this adoption of AI in the industrial sector, which I think can raise, both concerns that we discussed, touched on. I mean, one concern is if the AI is foreign, is sort of that we lose a strategic technology, mastering a strategic technology, and that could put our sovereignty sort of at risk. So that's one concern. And I think the only response to this is we need to have companies in Europe that are actually able to master the technology. That doesn't mean that every AI technology needs to be made in Europe. That's, of course, nonsense. But you need to have a critical mass of technology hubs, technology companies to be able to master these technologies. Otherwise, you will really lose the game. I think that's sort of one issue that the paper discusses. And the other one is the whole point about access to data and who learns from data and who can train from data. And I think indeed, as Julia says, I mean, there's the decreasing returns to scale, but then there's also increasing returns to scope. So meaning the more data you have, the more you can also link across different policy areas and different application areas, and the better it becomes your AI. And so there is really this question, how to make sure that data that is being used can be used for training of algorithms of competitors, so to avoid basically monopolistic markets.
Mm. And the institutions we currently have governing this, are they equipped to deal with it, or do we need new ones?
Well, I mean, that's a very big question. I think there's definitely need for investment. Whether it's new institutions needed or whether the existing institutions need to be beefed up, I don't have an answer for that. But I think there is scope for hiring additional people that actually master these technologies and could sort of advance the supervision and the management of these technologies.
I mean, if I can add something, I think one element that I thought was a bit weak in the white paper is that it doesn't put that much emphasis on small businesses, which are actually lagging behind not only in AI adoption, but also in digitization, the very first step. In fact, half of the top European firms have implemented AI in at least one of their business operations. So we're not doing that bad. It's comparable with the US. But perhaps more emphasis should be put. And there is some language in that direction on helping small enterprises catching up.
And what are the ideas for that?
So they propose to create a lighthouse center, they call, for research and innovation that could also translate into a digital innovation hub that would support uptake for SMEs. But then, I mean, you know, if a lot of the uptake relies on 5G powered sensors within manufacturing plants, for instance, and if we're in an area where there's just not the digital infrastructure to support that, then I'm not sure what it means.
Yeah, I suppose it's going to be fascinating to watch large companies adapt to AI in the decades to come, but I think it's going to be just as interesting to watch small and medium-sized companies and just our regular high street and how it changes over the years to come as well. Anyway, we've been going for quite a while, so I think we'll wrap things up here. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you, Julia, for joining us. Thank you, Guntram. If you enjoyed this podcast, I don't need an algorithm to tell you that you'll enjoy our other podcasts too. And to get all of them without interruption, all you have to do is click the subscribe button and you'll have everything on your phone immediately. And we promise we won't spy on you much. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you for listening to The Sound of Economics. And some housekeeping. Google is looking for a press and communications officer. Perhaps you can do my job. If you're listening to this podcast, that means you're already interested enough in economics to listen to this podcast, which means you may be halfway there. So if you've worked in press and communications before and you're interested in economics and a lot of the other work we do, you can find a job listing for the Google Press and Communication Officer's position on LinkedIn or at google.org. This podcast was presented by me, Nicholas Barrett, and edited by Tiago Almeida, and brought to you by the Bruegel Think Tank in Brussels. To read our papers and blogs, you can visit bruegel.org. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you can subscribe on Spotify and iTunes, where you can also leave us a review and let other people know that we exist. And you can stay up to date with everything we do by following us on Twitter at bruegel_org. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll see you next time.